You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Well, hello, friends. So in this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Peter Stavros. We talk about his story about a severe health crisis and how that health scare shifted his life path away from practicing law to pursuing his long-held dream of becoming a writer. Now, a lot of people have a dream of writing a novel, but most of us are never going to do it. We just don't. But Pete did. And one of the things I ask him is whether or not he thinks that he actually could have or would have written these books anyway if he hadn't had the health crisis. What does he say? You have to listen to hear his answer. So if you're ready, I'm ready. Let's go. Pete Stavros, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting.
Thanks, Amy. Glad to be here. Glad to have some time to talk with you.
Absolutely. I'm happy you're here. And are you ready for a chat?
I am, yeah.
Let's do it. So I start every interview asking people where in the world they are. Where on the blue marble are you when you're talking to me today?
I'm in Louisville, Kentucky.
We're not actually that far apart. I'm down in Miami, Florida. So, you know, yeah.
I like Miami. I go down to the Keys, not as often as I'd like to, but yeah.
Definitely. Well, it's a trek. It's a trek all the way down to the Keys. So for me, the closest, I mean, I'm in Miami and the closest key is 45 minutes, which is not very far, but Key West is a drive. All right. So before we dig in, I'd love to learn a little bit more about the people that I'm talking to just as people. Outside of your family and outside of your work, tell me a little something about you, a hobby, a pastime, something you enjoy doing that you're willing to share with the people of the world on the podcast.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I like to run. I've got a half marathon coming up here in a few weeks. So I was just actually out this morning going for a run in sort of like hurricane conditions. You might be able to relate to it. It's super windy out here today, but yeah, I took a run this morning and hopefully I'll be in shape in a couple of weeks. So we'll see.
Very good.
How
is
goes.
This your first half marathon or you've done a bunch?
Yeah, I've done a ton. Like I do two a year. I do one in the spring, one in the fall. And this one's kind of like, it's connected to the Kentucky Derby. It's like 2 weeks before the Derby. So it's kind of like it's a big one. So it's very packed. You're running like shoulder to shoulder with people the whole time, but it's fun. It's good.
It's a great place to run. And I have done a lot of running. I used to love to do the Ragnar races. They used to have one in Kentucky. It was all about bourbon. I never did it because the races fell apart, but it was on the list of things to do. And fun stuff. Good luck in your half marathon. I will be cheering you on from here. All right. So now to get to the topic of the day, which is how a significant health scare pushed you to make a change in your life. So yeah. Like a lot of change in your life. Did that sound like something you want to talk about today?
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to begin before the beginning. I'm going to back way up on the timeline and ask you what you were like as a kid. What did you like in school? What did you dream of being when you grew up? Were you like a sporty kid? Tell us about you when you were younger.
Yeah, I was like a super overachiever. I've studied all the time. I did like sports. I didn't run as much back then, but I liked playing little league, playing basketball, all that kind of stuff. So, but yeah, I was always kind of like just threw myself into whatever activity, got my attention at the time. So did a lot of writing. I kept a journal all the way back. I mean, when I was a kid, I'd always like journal a lot. So I've always been like really interested in writing as well.
All right, very good. And so you're a good student, always doing those things. We're going to talk about health and a rocky period of your health. So we know now today you're a runner. We know you were sporty as a kid. Before this health incident happened, would you have described yourself as living a pretty healthy lifestyle, in quotation marks, like healthy lifestyle?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I did triathlons. I go to the gym, bikes, cycle, run, swim, all that stuff. Felt great. Like I felt great all the way up until I didn't feel great. It just kind of happened just like that. And it was like part of this whole thing was just like, wow, how did this even happen? Because I never got sick. I went to the hospital to get my tonsils taken out when I was like 10. But all of a sudden that just became a part of my life, being in the hospitals, being sick, being in pain. So yeah, it's quite a change for me.
So a rapid change. Okay, so let's dive in the deep end and talk about it. In 2011, you're struck with a severe case of ulcerative colitis. Without being too icky, can you explain what this is? Like, explain to the people who are listening, like what colitis is, what ulcerative colitis is, and how it hit you.
Yeah, it's a chronic disease. It's an inflammation of the intestines, and so obviously what comes with that, a lot of stomach issues, a lot of discomfort, a lot of icky stuff coming out of you
That's why I was like, don't
to
get too icky, because like.
right. Right. But this happened so quickly. It happened on Valentine's Day. I'll never forget, because my wife and I were going to order heart-shaped pizza from this place down the street and a bottle of wine to stay and have this a quiet Valentine's Day. I couldn't do it. I was just wasn't feeling good, and progressively got sicker and sicker and sicker. And 3 weeks later, I was, diagnosed with colitis, ulcerative colitis. Took some medicine. The medicine didn't take. And then, like, I guess 3 weeks after that, it's pretty close to the day here. It was like March 21st. I was admitted to the hospital. I'd lost like 50 pounds in those 6 weeks or whatever. Super weak, couldn't do anything. So I had they x-rayed my stomach or whatever, and they said, the doctor wants you in surgery right away. It's like late at night. My colon had just like basically disintegrated, is what my understanding of it, and all the icky stuff was going around. So I had to have my colon removed like instantly that night, emergency
So,
surgery.
oh my gosh. Okay, so when you talk about severe, okay, so that is severe. That I think of a colon as being an important part of the body that we want to keep in our stomach, not have it taken out. Okay, so you had no history of GI challenges before this happened then.
No, none.
None. And then how did it feel? So you didn't feel good for 3 to 6 weeks. You were not feeling good. Give us like a sense of like what did that not feeling good feel like?
Well,
Describe it a little bit more.
just like the worst stomach ache. I had fevers. I had night sweats. It's not like we live in a mansion. We have a two-story Cape Cod house, but I couldn't even get up the stairs at night to go to bed. So I kind of camped out here on the living room, and my wife had to put a fan, at my feet just to, keep me cool at night. And I was so weak. I tried to do some work from home. I was able to do that for like a week or so, but then I was just like, I couldn't concentrate, couldn't keep anything inside, couldn't eat. Yeah, I just felt really, really sick and really, like I said, really weak, because I'd lost so much weight. Probably could have stood to, lose some weight anyway, but it was like not that much, not that quickly. So, yeah, it was just rapid decline.
So 50 pounds in 6 weeks, that's fast. That's a lot of weight and that's fast. So you felt terrible. You felt fluish, like feverish, and
Yeah.
also really, really weak. And so you knew
Really
something was
anxious.
very, very wrong. And any feedback from your doctors as like until you ended up in the hospital?
I remember the first doctor I saw wanted to know if I'd been out hiking and drink water from any streams, and you ever get to
Oh,
know me,
so
I would not
Giardia,
do
yeah.
anything like that. Interesting enough, though, my wife actually has colitis. She got colitis like shortly after we were married. So, and we were active in fundraising for the Crohn's Colitis Foundation. So I was aware of the symptoms, and I'm aware of the disease and the treatments and stuff like that. So it wasn't completely foreign to me, but yet it was still a shock to for me to have it as well. Several years after she was diagnosed with it.
That's crazy, actually. So you were involved in it because it's not something that's contagious, like person to person, as far as I know.
As far as we know. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but yeah, so it was so weird. And so fortunately she was able to keep it under control, and she still is with medication, but the medicine it just wasn't working for me at all. So yeah.
So in this 6 week period, did they do some things before you ended up having the radical surgery to remove your colon? Like, so what did they try before that?
Yeah, I can't recall the names of the medication, but there are different types of medicine. And my understanding is that the medicine for colitis, it's kind of like it works differently for different people, and you got
Yeah, I
different
don't know.
combinations and that sort of thing. So they were trying different combinations of medicine with me, and it was just not working at all. So I was, finally relieved to go to the hospital, and I thought, oh, I'm just going to get like an IV and whatever, I'll be good as new. And that's when, like, I found it has. My colon had to be removed, so, or what was left of it. So.
What did that feel like? Because you had been, it sounds like you had been really being intentional about and assertive and looking for treatment, but still you end up in the hospital and you get this dramatic announcement. What did that feel like at the time?
At the time, I was just so weak, and like it was like my recollection was it was like I felt like it was the middle of the night, and it was like this empty operating room, and I could sense like people slowly gathering and taking off. It was cold out there, taking off their heavy jackets and preparing to, for my operation. And I was introduced to my surgeon, who we've kept close, this whole time. I still see him, and the other members of the team. And it was just announced. I mean, they said, this is, I mean, the colon has to come out. And I was just so weak and sick at that point. I'm just like, whatever has to be done, do it. And I was, like I said, I was aware of the surgery. I knew I was in for a, a long road ahead, but I was at that point, I was just so sick and there was nothing else to do. So I'm just like, yeah, go for it.
Oh, so you really felt like there was no other option, and it did happen fast. Like you checked in and you were having surgery like pretty quickly, or was there a delay?
No, I, 'cause like I said, I don't know what day of the week it was, but I got in the after that afternoon, and later that day they x-rayed my belly. And then I remember I was coming back, they're pushing me back to the hospital room, and the nurse was on the phone outside my room, and she seemed really serious. And I had this feeling like, I bet that's about me. And so when she hung up, she's like, nothing to eat or drink. She's like, the doctor wants you in surgery right away. So
So that's very fast. But you were too sick and too feeling too crappy to even be nervous then. You were just like, whatever.
And I've talked to other people who've had this same surgery, and for them it's like it's a big decision whether or not you want to lose your colon. It's, I mean, it's a lifestyle change, but for me it was just like there's no alternative. I did so on that aspect, I didn't have to overthink, and I tend to be an overthinker, so I was just like nothing to think about there. I just go ahead.
Yeah, no, this is you were in the burning building. Like it's like that, whatever I can do. Yeah, absolutely. All right. So you have the surgery, which I agree with you 100%. If somebody came to me today and they were like, "Hey, Aim, what we want to do is want to remove an organ from your body." I'd be like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa. Let's talk about it." That's a major procedure. In the intake form before this interview, you shared that it took you a year to recover to try and get back to your prior level of health. So, what you had a decline before even the surgery, but then you have this major surgery. And then I'm going to guess that not having a colon changes how your day-to-day life goes, at least for a little while. What were you working on health-wise for that year?
Well, like aside from my issue with the colon, because everything was sort of spilling out inside of me, I had like kidney failure, and so I had like edema. My feet were like swollen to like 40 pounds each, so
Oh
I couldn't.
my gosh.
So I basically had to like learn how to walk again. I had to have occupational and physical therapy just to be able to get around. And then, of course, you have the ostomy, which is different. It's a, the way I think of it, it's like a piece of my intestine that should be in the inside, which is now on the outside, and it's just helping to save my life, but it's still kind of, we'll say icky.
That's
It's
the, I think
in
that's the technical term.
my
That's the technical medical term for the ostomy bag is icky.
And so and it affects what I eat, because you don't want to get anything clogged in there. It's a very small, opening. And you have to keep it clean. You have to, maintain the pouch and all that sort of stuff. So it was a different lifestyle change, but it was a series of three surgeries. So the first one was take the colon out. The second one came in like September, which was to take the rest of the colon out, because they the first time they had to just like kind of like do what they could to kind of stabilize me. So I take the rest of whatever was in there. And then they create this thing called a J pouch. I don't know the medical term, but it's called a J pouch, which is my small intestine basically is going to be pulling double duty for what I'm missing in my colon, and also for itself. So that'll be inside of me. And then the third surgery was in December, which is I kind of hook everything up, put everything back inside, and I'm good to go. So.
You're like the, what was, there's the old, so I have two film movie references that popped into my head while you were talking about that. The first is, first time I heard of an ostomy bag was in the movie. Oh my goodness, it's the Farrell brothers, and he's a divorce attorney, and he's going to see his partner, and his partner's like 1,000 years old, and on the table is a magazine about living without intestines. After I saw the movie, what is the name of the movie? I'll think of it in a second. After I saw the movie, I was like, let me look up what that is, and I was like, oh, who knew that that's a thing. But then the other thing, as you were telling that story, that just popped into my mind was, oh, it's totally escaped me already. I'm totally thinking about the ostomy bag. But anyway, moving on. That's so you had three surgeries back to back. One which was like emergency,
Actually.
like crisis. Well, not back to back, but over time. And so you were very, very. Were you able to work at this time? At any of
No,
this time? So you took like a
no,
full
no.
year off of your like corporate job.
Yeah, I was on disability. But the thing is, like, I would have to, after every surgery, I was so beaten down that I would have to actually get myself back in shape just to be well enough to have the other surgery that was going to beat me back down again. So.
Wow. Okay. So that is a lot. So a year is a long time. A year is a long time. You were very, very sick when you started. And a year is a long time. And this was not elective. At each of these points, you're dealing with like, this is, you're sick and you want to be less sick. If you had to pick three words to describe your state of mind as you were going through this year, what would those be for that year of like intense recovery?
You know, oddly enough, one of them would be hopeful. I was hopeful. I felt like this sort of like, I felt positive about it for some reason, even though how dire my situation was. And don't get me wrong, I was definitely bummed out about it, to say the least. But yet, I felt like there was going to be something positive to come from this. I just felt hopeful, positive, I started writing again, and I hadn't written, I'd written, and then I went to law school, and I think when I went to law school, something shut down in my brain, the writing part of it, and so I couldn't write anymore. But then, like, I remember being in the hospital in an intensive care unit, like, whenever I woke up after that first surgery, and I asked my wife to go down to the lobby shop and get me a notebook because I'm going to start writing all this stuff down, because I'm like, this is going to make a really good story when I fully recover. And so I wrote everything about it for that whole year, and that really helped me as well.
That is so that so you had mentioned that you were a writer as a kid, in a journal, and then as a profession you went into law. And I happen to think of lawyers as writers because they're writing contracts or agreements or whatever briefs or what are all the different kinds of lawyer of writing that lawyers do. But you had stopped writing for
Creatively,
joy, yeah, and
yeah.
creatively. Sure, absolutely. So this is very much an acute health situation that you were going through, unexpected, and it's like continuing. But the impact of this recovery like goes totally past just the health situation that you were in your story, right? So you were unable to work, you were on disability. At some point, you begin to shift and reevaluate your professional career as a result of this. So does that start with go get me a book from a journal from the gift shop, or how does that process happen? Tell me, walk me through how this unfolds.
Absolutely. It was just like, oh, it's like I could be a writer again. Like, I always wanted to be a writer. I never wanted to go to law school or anything. I could admit that. I don't think I'm the only person who could admit such a thing, but it just sort of happened. But I always wanted to be a writer, and it just sort of like, unblocked me at that time. And I started re realizing, and you realize when something like this happens, well, life's kind of short, and life is kind of uncertain, and not to sound cliche about it, but it's, you never know what's going to happen. So I always wanted to be a writer, so I just started writing again. I returned to work, and it was weird. Like, when I went back to work, at the job I had, everything in my office had was the same way it was when I left. And I'm like, and it hit me like, wow, this is weird. Like, I don't want to be back where I was. I want to move on to something else. It's almost like a time capsule thing. Like, did that last year even happen to me? And I had to keep telling myself it happened to you, and you need to learn from it. You need to move on from it. And so, while I did continue to work, I also continued to write. And then I met with a former classmate of mine who's a life coach, who sort of, I think she kind of specializes in getting attorneys out of their legal profession or something.
Really? Okay.
Because she's a former attorney herself, so I started meeting with her, and then we just over time kind of just developed this plan for me. So I mean, it took a while, and the longer it took, the more sort of like disappointed myself I was, and then I'm like, haven't you learned anything from this? Don't go back to this same routine that you didn't like. But it was, yeah, it's difficult to, like, leave your job and benefits and steady work and all that, just for this sort of unknown thing.
Well,
But
and let's talk about that for a second, because you in the United States where you and I live, our medical care is tied often to our employers. So you were going through, you went through this very intensive medical procedure. So you go back to the same job that you had, which actually is an amazing gift, right? There could, like, you could have been, there is another version of the story where you could have been pushed out of your job or unable to go back.
yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah. And so then you have the golden handcuffs of you have this job, you have the benefits, you have the gratitude towards these people who let you take a year off and then brought you back. And yet you've got this current going through your head, which is like, you know, this is not what I want to be doing. Like, I want to make a shift. But it's not an instant shift, which you talk about. So, in your timeline you gave me, 2011 is the medical crisis, the first round of it. 9 years later is when you quit the
Crazy.
job.
Yeah, I switched jobs. I went to a different job. I went in, worked for a university. I thought that might be sort of less stressful, different atmosphere, and it was good as well, because it helped also sort of like spark that, I guess, that college student that I was when I was writing and stuff like that. So it kind of sparked my creativity, and I was grateful for that job as well. But being a lawyer is being a lawyer, no matter where you are, is what I've discovered. So,
So, what did you study before you went to law school? Did you study, what was your undergraduate major?
creative writing. Yeah.
Creative writing. So this
Yeah.
is not like this was in there. You were a writer as a kid, you did creative writing, and then you made your deal with the professional gods and said, I will go to law school so I can pay my bills, but now you're coming back to writing. So you change jobs, so you're not at the law firm, but you're at a university, but you decide to write a novel. I mentioned this, I do think of lawyers as writers because they're constantly producing all of those documents, right? It's not an unheard of wish for people to want to write a book, but did you know how to write a book, or did you have to go out and learn how to write a book?
Yeah, no, I've got several books that, as they say, in my dresser drawer, that haven't seen the light of day, but it was still a good practice. But yes, yeah, as an undergrad, I wrote a book, and in grad school, I
Okay.
wrote a book as well. So yeah.
So you knew how you had, that's an amazing head start. Okay, so then most people like don't write the books that they have in their head. I think something crazy like 80% of adults say that they'd like to write a book. Most people like don't actually do it. What how did you make the jump from the manuscript in your drawer to quitting the job and pitching the book or publishing the book, however
Yeah,
it
I
came
mean,
to
like
be?
I said, yeah, I finally just had to make that, I had to make that move. And, after I was really kind of sort of miserable in the last job I had, nothing to do with the place itself, but just with being an attorney. And I remember I had sort of this dream or whatever, where the whole plot of this book was like played out in my head, almost like I was watching it in a movie. And it got me really sort of jazzed up to like, okay, let's go for it. Let's just quit this job and devote everything to the book. And I had the support of my wife, who was very supportive of me in that. And so it was March of 2020 that I went to my boss's office and just very nicely said, it's time for me to move on or whatever. And then the next week, the world sort of
I
shut
was gonna
down.
say, if you had waited, I was gonna ask you when this was because, like, you could have skipped that meeting, maybe.
Could have skipped it, although on the other hand, if I would have waited and then everyone's like locked down and all that, and then I would have felt kind of guilty for leaving my department, I guess. So, and that was like one of the concerns I had was, okay, you're going to leave this job and you're going to be home alone. Well, everybody was home alone, so it was sort of like an easier transition. But then I had tons of time to go ahead and to write.
To go ahead and write, you had the support of your wife. What were
Yeah.
your fears? What were you afraid of in making this jump?
The uncertainty of it. I'm very much someone on who likes a routine, who likes some steady, obviously like a steady income as well. So I didn't have
Yeah.
that. And I've since moved on to do some. I still do like legal consulting work on the side remotely, to pay the bills. But yeah, there's just that fear of the unknown, and like I said, the fear of like being alone all day in a quiet house. So it turns out my wife was, sitting here at the dining room table working while I was on the couch writing my book. So it was good that way. We kind of had that, I saw the company of somebody around. So, But other than that, no, those were the, that was it. I just knew that I had to do this, you know.
You just felt the drive that you needed to do it. All right. So you write the book. The novel is called The Thing About My Uncle. It released in August of 2024.
Yeah.
I checked. It's available in all the places that I order books. It's out there. A more forward-looking host would have gotten ordered the book and read it before it got here, but I ordered it getting ready for today. I will have read it by the time it goes live. It will go on the bookshelf with the other authors I've gotten the chance to interview, so that'll be super fun. This is not, does this, was this an existing storyline that you had, or this was a new idea that you came up with after the events?
Yeah, I had bits and pieces in my head. The first year out of my first year out of law school, I clerked for a judge in a very small Eastern Kentucky town. So I took the setting from that and put it in my book. And there, without giving too much away about my book, but I would also go out on the weekends and ride my mountain bike on these old cold trails. And that plays a big part of the book as well. And I was always warned, don't go off the trail because there's people are putting things in the woods there because they're growing stuff and they want to protect it. And so, without giving too much away, they'll be
Okay. All
growing
right.
something that might not be legal in all states, and they want to keep you. So that's that. I thought I was like terrified of that, obviously at the time. But then I'm like, well, this is gonna be that'd be pretty cool to put, you know, make a story around. So yeah, bits and pieces like that.
Right, very good. So let me ask you a question. So you made this transition. It was really, really accelerated by this health struggle, right? But it also is something that you had wanted to do from when you were maybe a young kid. So do you think there's another, do you think you would have eventually done this anyway? Do you think that there's a, you know, if you had not had the acute health struggle, do you think that you would have found your way to writing books and releasing them? Or do you think that it was, are you in some ways thankful for the scare?
I really am. I mean, yeah, it kind of sounds weird, but I think it's, but for me getting sick, I don't think that switch in my head that would turn on that turned on the creative writing, you know, aspect of me. I don't know if that would have gotten flipped because I think I would have just stayed in this rut of, you know, 9 to 5, let's review contracts and manage litigation and all this stuff and not, you know, take that leap. So yeah, I mean, I kind of view it that way. Yeah. And like I said, when I first got sick, I just had this feeling that something good was going to come out of this.
That's interesting. So we call that like the mind-body connection, right? It's like when your body failed, then you began to look at other things. Like it's just like it's the drop in the pond, and it sort of goes, it touches everything else. So that's an interesting. All right. So you gave me specific links for the books. I'm going to put those in the show notes. They'll be in YouTube, on Apple, on Spotify. They'll be in the email newsletter that I send to everybody who subscribes. So if you're listening and you're out for a walk or in the car, you don't have to scramble for where to find it. Just sign up for the email list at Imperfect Adulting, and I'll send it right to your email list. In a second, we're going to wrap this up with final questions. But before we do that, I want to give you a chance to tell the listeners about, you know, anything else that they might want to know about you, future projects you're working on, how they can connect with you as to follow you as an author, anything that you want to share.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a website. It's www.peterjstavros.com. And then I'm on, you know, X and Instagram at Peter J. Stavros. And I've got stuff coming up. I've written, you know, a book about this health ordeal that I'm shopping around now. And I've got another novel in the works as well. So I just keep writing.
How does
It
it feel to say that? How does it feel to say that
feels great.
you've got a published book and you've got two more books in the works? That's the dream, right?
Actually, yeah. Yeah, it's great.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. All right, so now, if you're ready, I'm going to ask you the three final questions. We'll wrap this up. Are you ready? Rapid fire, just for fun. Don't worry about it. Whatever comes to mind. We'll start with an easy one. Are you an, I think I could guess this now, but I did not know anything about you when I wrote this down. Are you a morning or an evening person?
Oh, yeah, I get a lot of work done in the morning.
So I would have guessed that because of the runner triathlete thing, because those races don't happen usually in the afternoon.
Quiet.
I don't know whether or not I was born a morning person or it was beaten into me by cross country training, but I am a morning person also. So all right, so this episode is actually going to come out after the spring holidays, and I know that you've got a particular diet that this could be a terrible question actually now that I think about it, because you have probably have a careful diet. But if I offered you three choices of sort of Easterish spring candy, which of these would you choose? Jelly beans, Peeps. Do you know what peeps are? The peeps?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. Or a milk chocolate in the shape of an egg. Which would you choose?
It's funny because when I was sick, it was around Easter time, and there were very few things I could eat, but I could eat jelly beans. I ate like a ton of jelly beans all the time. So yeah, that's definitely with jelly beans.
That, okay. And do you eat the black jelly beans? Because that's the controversial question, right? Do you eat the black ones or not?
Yeah, I like them all.
You like them all. All right, very
Yeah.
good. Okay. Now you've got plenty of life experience. And I want you to think about the worst travel experience you've ever had in your life. So the worst travel experience you've ever had, worst hotel or travel or plane or whatever. Where was it and what happened?
My gosh, probably, well, I guess me and my buddy in college, we went to Myrtle Beach shortly after, I guess it was Hurricane Hugo. And we had made the reservations before, and we kind of kept the reservations, and the hotel pretty much, there wasn't much to it. So they hadn't really done much to clean it up or anything. The pool was full of mud, and we made the most of it, but yeah, it wasn't a 5-star resort to say the
That is
least.
very, so you did, was it one of the Myrtle Beach hotels that has the lazy river in it? Like the,
Yeah,
yeah.
it was, I just remember just a ton of mud, but
So
it
funny. That's so funny. Myrtle Beach can be a lot of fun, but it's a unique place. It definitely is. All
was
right.
fun.
That's it, Pete Stavros. Thank you so much for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
So much. I really enjoyed it, Amy. Thank you.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.